From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
On the panel this week, Richard Lautendresse, Washington correspondent for Canadian broadcaster TV8 Nouvelle, and Oren Durrell, foreign affairs reporter for USA Today. Our moderator is White House correspondent for the Weekly Standard, Michael Warren.
Welcome, everyone. I'm your moderator, Michael Warren, and here are the issues. Donald Trump heads to Singapore for an historic summit with Kim Jong-un of North Korea. The American president hopes to broker a deal to verifiably and permanently dismantle North Korea's nuclear weapons program. U.S. allies in the European Union and North America are hitting back at the Trump administration's forthcoming tariffs, but the president is also getting some serious opposition to his trade policy from another group of allies, members of his own party in Congress. And finally, a Supreme Court decision this week sides with a Christian baker who refused to sell a cake for a same-sex wedding, citing his personal religious objections. What did the court say and what didn't it say about the tension between religious liberty and the broader cultural acceptance of gay marriage in the United States? And we first talk about the upcoming summit in Singapore on June 12th. Richard, tell us exactly what do we know about the president's preparation for this summit, and what can you tell us about what we should be watching for as the president and Kim Jong-un travel to Singapore?
Well, the expectations, I think, Michael, are have been lowered, which is a good thing. The ultimate objective of denuclearization of North Korea is so big and so large as a topic to work on that the simple fact that they will meet and they will agree on a framework and agree on continuing the discussions. It sounds like the president, again, repeats, this is something that was not in the narrative at the beginning. Now he says, not during this first meeting, he talks about other ones. So this is an interesting one. As for the preparation itself, we had a surprise on Thursday when the president, sitting in the Oval Office with Shinzo Abe, the Japanese prime minister, acknowledged that actually he didn't prepare much. He prepared for the last 20 years, meaning that it's his style of negotiating, his way of facing Kim Jong-un, which will bring the entire negotiation further than whatever he will have had gone through as files and documents.
Yeah, the president always says he knows how to make deals. But, of course, Oren, there's the issue of the North Koreans. People have pointed out, analysts have pointed out, that a lot of the negotiators and sort of the run-up of this Singapore summit have been negotiating on North Korea's behalf with American administrations on this nuclear question for decades. Some of the exact same people since the agreed framework back in the 1990s. Are the North Koreans going to hose the President of the United States and show him that they are more prepared than perhaps he is going into Singapore?
So a couple of points on that. But first, I wanted to go back to the preparation issue. There may be a difference in opinion on what the president meant by when he said that he doesn't need to prepare, because Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said, actually, the president has been preparing since he took office. We've been having almost daily briefings on North Korea. So he's very well versed on what's happening in North Korea. And they've been talking about it continuously during this administration. The North Korean negotiating team has been involved in, it's the same people have been involved in these types of negotiations for a couple of decades. And I would say that they've already shown a lot of deft diplomacy, because without even meeting with President Trump, without having any kind of an agreement, without actually agreeing to anything, they've already gotten half of the this maximum pressure campaign lifted, which was the diplomatic half. People forget that there was economic sanctions, but also the other part of the maximum pressure was this this isolation and cutting off of North Korea. And a lot of that is disappearing now, because they've had meetings with the South Koreans between the two leaders. They've had meetings with Foreign Minister Lavrov of Russia. The Russians invited Kim Jong-un to Vladivostok for a conference in September. There's a lot of things that are happening. And I think that, we should also mention that the North Korean wish list for this meeting is very different from what the Americans have in mind.
I think this is a big question, and something I'm hearing from experts on North Korea preparing for this trip, concern that there's almost two different definitions of denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, right? That the president in the United States has one idea, which is this complete verifiable destruction of the nuclear program, but that Kim Jong-un's conception of it is to also remove the nuclear umbrella that the United States provides to South Korea and Japan and others. This question of the definition, Richard, of denuclearization, is this going to be the most important thing that that the two leaders agree upon? Can they come to an agreement, or can we expect Kim Jong-un to hold tight to what the North Koreans have always said about denuclearization?
It brings us back, Michael, to exactly what you're saying, the definition of not only the words themselves, but the concept they have in mind. And I even believe that even the American definition of verifiable, complete denuclearization is not clear. Are we talking about not only getting rid of the nuclear arsenal, but also the nuclear program and even the civilian aspect of it? We haven't gone far on this. And this is why when we talk about getting ready for this summit, even if the president has had a certain number of briefings, and Mike Pompeo knows more about what we can do with the North Korean than the president himself, still, we haven't been informed very clearly on what was done. You're talking about the nuclear umbrella, the American nuclear umbrella on South Korea, but the American military presence in South Korea is probably perceived as part of this denuclearization wave or demilitarization of the peninsula. If they give something, if they were to give the North Korean anything, it probably will imply also that the Americans will walk away from South Korea. What I mean in all this is that we haven't been given really clear path of negotiations as this is what precisely will be traded in the negotiations.
And I think that's what's so different about this summit, as opposed to previous American administrations having summits like these, which is all of the meetings beforehand kind of hammer out what the two principals are going to talk about. That's not really what's happened here. I've talked to a few Korea experts who say that exact point that Richard raised, that what is it that the United States is willing to give if they are going to be getting some kind of denuclearization agreement from the North Koreans? The question of the 28,000 American troops. James Mattis, the defense secretary, said that was on the table. Recently, he said that's not happening. But we learned from the Washington Post this week that the president thinks that there's not necessarily a strategic reason to have American troops there. Oren, what is on the table for the Americans? What could the president be willing to trade away or negotiate in order to get some kind of deal with Kim?
So the president has talked about that. And he has said North Korea could have, it could be a beautiful thing in North Korea. So there would be economic benefits for North Korea. There would be, he's talked about investment that even, first of all, that U.S. sanctions would not lift until the CVID, complete, verifiable, irreversible denuclearization happens. That has not exactly been, like Richard said, that's not been exactly defined what that would mean. But if the talks go well, then he said the South Koreans and the Chinese and the Japanese basically will get a green light to make investments and provide some financial assistance to North Korea. The North Koreans have a very poor country, and they need a lot of economic development. And that's one of the major things that President Trump has been offering, that North Korea can become a member of the community of nations and have normal economic relations with any country that it wants if it goes through these steps of denuclearization. That would involve diplomatic relations between the United States and North Korea, possibly. He's talked about bringing something before Congress that would protect any agreement, which basically would be a treaty. He's talked about making sure that Kim feels secure and that his regime can last for decades. And what that means is, again, some kind of a peace agreement, an end to the Korean War. And basically relations between the United States and this country that is like a prison state to its people.
Well, I think that there's a lot of questions, even his own allies, the president's own allies in Congress have, about whether or not the president would even be willing to walk away, or if the fact that the summit is happening suggests that the president will accept pretty much anything as some kind of progress. Do either of you, Orrin or Richard, have any sense of whether or not the president would be willing to do as President Reagan did in Reykjavik, walk away from the table if he feels that Kim is not willing to give him a deal that's good enough for him?
Well, on Thursday, he said he would. He would walk away if he's not happy. And he claims that that's what he did previously. And we understand that he's talking about the Iran nuclear deal. But the Iran nuclear deal was a long negotiated, well worked on piece of negotiation. It was planned long in advance. It was detailed and all this. He's walking away for other reasons than the nuclear agreement itself, the Iranian influence in the region. We know the reasons. In this case, he would walk away and then leave what behind would be what we have at the moment, a rogue nuclear state that threatens the region, just like Shinzo Abe came to the White House to remind the president that the alternative to doing something is being more afraid than they are at the moment.
We will. We've got to take a break here. We'll get back to issues in just a moment. We'll be watching, of course, what happens in Singapore next week.
Here's a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News on the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. And don't forget to like us on Facebook, Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel. Richard Lottendress, White House correspondent for Canadian broadcaster TV8 Nouvelle, and Orrin Durrell, foreign affairs reporter for USA Today. Our moderator is Michael Warren, White House correspondent for the Weekly Standard.
And Orrin, before we went to break, you had a final point about Singapore and the Kim-Trump summit.
Yeah, so I think that we have to be kind of realistic about what to expect from this summit. And President Trump has said, he said on Thursday, this is about building relationships. They had this idea of having a big, bold, you know, they've talked about they want North Korea to make a big, bold move to denuclearize, to do it quickly, to get it done. They would like to get it done somehow during this administration or, you know, if it goes to a second term at that point. The timing is uncertain because it's a big and complicated process. But what this meeting on the 12th of June is about building a relationship. Trump wants to build a relationship with Kim Jong-un. I don't think he's going to walk away. I think he's going to be, he's going to want Kim to say something minimal, at least, about he agrees to denuclearization. Kim and his father and his grandfather have talked about denuclearization since the beginning of their nuclear programs. So I don't think that's going to be a hard one to get. But the main point here is to get this process going, to have a relationship. And this is Trump's way of negotiating, is to build a relationship with the people that he's negotiating with and to make everything feel warm and cozy and then to start making demands.
Well, speaking of relationships, the president had some rough relationships with some of America's allies in both North America and the European Union ahead of this G7 summit that is happening this weekend. Richard, can you bring us up to speed a little bit about what is this dispute over? We know it's about tariffs. We know it's about the American trade policy. What's happening and what might we expect out of this G7 summit?
Well, I think that this G7 summit happens at the worst moment for the Western world alliance, or getting organized between allies in Europe and North America, because at this very moment, the president has decided to put pressure on his allies. He wants to renegotiate. We know very well, we've been working on this for a year and a half now, the NAFTA agreement. It's not going the way he wanted to. So bringing those tariffs on would put pressure on Canada and Mexico. And then he's not happy with the trade deficit. He repeats it all the time with his European allies. So he came up with the tariffs. And these tariffs are perceived fundamentally, since we're using the Section 232, which justify for national security imposing these type of tariffs, it's perceived for us Canadians and even, and of course, Europeans, as you are a threat, you are a physical threat to the United States. So we have to use those tariffs. There's absolutely no notion anywhere in our daily business between Canadians and Americans and Europeans and Americans that there is a danger. But using, even if the Canadians see the American tactic, it remains... some sort, and I think the Prime Minister Trudeau verbalized it the best way, some sort of an insult to use this argument. And by extension, so meeting in Charlevoix in Quebec, such a beautiful region, is the worst place and the worst moment because the president has a totally different agenda, and a G7 was supposed to be this opportunity to get together and say, we have actually a common vision of the world that should go this way, that should move that in that direction, and they are not on the same wavelength.
No, not at all. And in fact, the feeling of insult sort of going back and forth on Twitter between the Canadian Prime Minister and President Trump. Oren, what does this mean for the summit? It could get pretty awkward amid all of these tensions over trade.
Well, I think that there are going to be visual outcomes and then there'll be written outcomes. And the visual outcomes will be these awkward-looking photo ops where they have a family photo, if they do one, where Trump may be, you know, people are not happy and they're not smiling and they're maybe he's somehow physically isolated or off to himself. The written outcomes, usually they come out with some kind of a joint communique. And some of the leaders have been saying that, you know, they're going to come up with a statement of values and objectives that may leave the United States out. Now, I think that it's important to note that the tariffs themselves, like Richard has said, are odious to the Europeans and the Canadians, but they're also they also come at the end, or at, you know, it might not be the end, but they come after a list of other things that have happened. The United States under Trump pulled out of the Paris climate deal. They pulled out of the Trans-Pacific Trade Pact. They pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal. They're trying to renegotiate NAFTA, and the Europeans have reacted to these things as trespasses on their sovereignty. So I don't think that this is going to be a good summit for the transatlantic relationship.
But, you know, you do think, Richard, back to the 2016 campaign, the idea that Trump ran on in many ways was to do exactly what Oren just described, and he's fulfilled that promise to essentially pull out of any international agreements and really judge each international agreement on the president's conception of what's in America's interests and sort of narrowly America's interests. So should the European and Canadian allies be surprised by what President Trump is doing? I'm sort of struck by the way every time the president fulfills what we would have thought he would do, the folks in the European Union and Canada act as if they couldn't see this coming.
You're perfectly right that we have heard him so many times in all sorts of ways preparing us to this type of moment. However, in this very case, I think what surprises the Canadians for sure and the Europeans too is that we are the closest allies the U.S. have. And so if you treat your allies this way, so where else will the Americans look for help when we're going to face, hopefully it will never happen again, but a tragedy like 9/11 or any other things where you need allies and close ones, not just like a vote at the UN, but close ones to help you on the ground somewhere. If you're not nurturing somehow or listening somehow to your allies, where are you going to get them? And I think that as long as the president was, for instance, the Paris Climate Accord, his agenda, his minding is against this way of looking at climate change and climate problems. That's one thing. But now you're attacking with the tariffs the Canadians and the Europeans for concessions on trade, which are, you know, debatable. Even trade deficits and trade surpluses are not something everybody agrees on. So, again, it's mainly the notion that we are your last allies. So when I hear the president say, well, Russia should be part of the G7, let's go back to the G8, it sounds like I've been fighting with the other ones, so I'm going to bring Russia as my new ally. So Russia is suddenly the good friend that the Canadians and the French and the Germans wouldn't be anymore, which is very strange for us.
And speaking of strange allies, we've been talking about foreign allies, but of course Republicans in Congress, who in many ways have gone along with President Trump's agenda broadly, and would probably be in large agreement with some of the president's decisions to pull out of the Iran nuclear deal or the Paris Climate Accords, they are challenging the president, or at least some are challenging the president, Oren, on the specific area of tariffs. Can you give us a little sense of what's happening with the president's supposed allies in Congress on this?
So the GOP and Republicans and Democrats in Congress are, I guess, with the backing of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, are proposing a bill that would require a congressional it's almost comical to me, but it would require congressional approval for the president to impose tariffs based on this national security provision. And it's not clear if this would pass, because a lot of these people are, these lawmakers are facing re-election in the fall, and it would basically put them at odds with the president. They're not looking for a fight with President Trump. But it shows that, you know, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce usually is very much a Republican-oriented organization. The lawmakers that are, a bunch of them that are involved in this are well-known and respected Republicans, and they're really worried about hurting the U.S. Trade relationship with its allies, like Richard said, and they're willing to take on the president to do that.
And finally here, the Supreme Court made a decision on a case that has a lot of interest. A baker in the state of Colorado who had refused to provide a wedding cake, to sell a wedding cake for a same-sex wedding, the court found narrowly, I would say, on the side of the baker against a anti-discrimination commission in the state of Colorado. Richard, can you explain a little bit about what this court reading, this court finding means, and maybe what it doesn't exactly mean?
Well, Justice Anthony Kennedy wrote this decision, and I think it's very interesting because he was the one who opened the door finally to legalizing, I don't know if it's the exact word, gay marriage. So he centered his opinion, his decision on the ability for Jack Phillips, this baker, to exercise freely his religious faith. He didn't, the decision itself doesn't it doesn't cover the way we should treat homosexuals, but mainly in this very case, the Colorado Commission was very harsh towards Jack Phillips' belief and religious beliefs, and therefore the Supreme Court decision centered on the fact that the commission had criticized the Colorado Commissions of Rights,
anti-discrimination of some kind.
Yes, exactly. Was very harsh towards Phillips, and is like had an attitude of disrespect towards his religious beliefs. And this, I think, what I like in what is interesting in Anthony Kennedy's decision is that it says as much as we should respect this this decision on gay marriage, we should also not forget that this is there's room and there's reality of the religious belief in this and forever for thousands of years. So we should balance the two.
And Oren, do we think that there's more to come in terms of jurisprudence on this question? Again, the finding was pretty narrow, as Richard pointed out. It really focused the majority opinion on the way this particular commission adjudicated this baker's case. Could we be seeing a bigger showdown over this real tension between religious liberty and religious objections to same-sex marriage, and again, a broader acceptance, very broad acceptance within the United States for gay marriage?
So this decision, yes. In short, yes. There's another case. Of course, the court accepted another case that it's going to review with, and I forget. I think it was with a florist and a baker or something, and it's a similar type of case. But the issue of when people are allowed to say no to gays has not actually been decided by the court. It seems that the court wants to say, don't discriminate against people for their religious beliefs, but also don't discriminate against people for their sexual orientation.
Well, that's all the time we have. Thanks to Oren Durrell, foreign affairs reporter for USA Today, and Richard Lattendress, Washington correspondent for Canadian broadcaster TVA Nouvelle. This program is produced by VOA's Current Affairs. Our engineer is Justin Thwaites. And I'm Michael Warren, White House correspondent for the Weekly Standard. Thanks for listening.